accession number 30048.
Now, I worked for Dave Schilling, and I did special trucking. I mean, New Year's Eve.
And what was your official capacity?
A special vehicle operator.
There's no such thing in the Army Air Force.
Yes, there is. Special vehicle operator. 696 or something like that.
Truck driver. Driver truck.
Yeah. The 345 was a regular truck driver.
Yeah.
Special vehicle operator. Special vehicles.
Yeah.
Like track vehicles.
Well, you were in the 62nd Squadron?
Oh, yeah.
You remember the 62nd?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
And Dave, well, I'll tell you a good example of what the type of thing Dave would have me do. New Year's Eve, or the day before New Year's Eve, in 1944, a C-47 made a forced landing out here with a load of cognac for General Doolittle's New Year's Eve party. Now, we had a black ice storm. I don't know if you remember that, but we had that black ice. Mm-hmm. And so they loaded that onto a weapons carrier. And Schilling said to me, Billy, he said, I got a job for you. He says, you got this cognac to get down the pine tree. I said, fine. I said, boy, here's where we get a little. But I didn't know I was going to have a full colonel riding shotgun with him. So I said to the colonel, we stopped at the mess hall. I said, I'm going to stop at the mess hall. He said, well, we don't have to eat. It's a short trip. I said, no. I said, you're sitting there with pinks and a light raincoat. You're going to freeze your butt. Well, I stopped at the mess hall and got cardboard and covered up the one side of the truck that so he, the wind wouldn't blow on. They were open cabs, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, we took about 6 hours to get to Braintree with the ice after sliding off the road a half a dozen times.
Mm-hmm.
And when we got there, old Jimmy Doolittle was all happy. They had master sergeants unload the truck. So then this colonel was telling Jimmy about how I bent the hood up to get heat on the windshield, you know.
Mm.
So all I said, well, look, I'd like to eat.
Mm.
He sent me right down in his mess hall. Got the biggest steak. Beautiful. So I asked him, I said, sir, I said, I got to get back to Box Hill. What's the weather like? So he talked to some weather office or something. And God, I even got you. You forgot me, girl?
No, I couldn't fit in on the train.
Oh, thank God for that. Well, anyway, this guy said it's clearing.
Mm.
Well, if you remember, we had a hell of a snowstorm that day. After that, around New Year's Day or something like that, we had a hell of a snowstorm. But the guy said the weather's clearing, you know. But that's the type of work I did for him, you know.
You say the C-47...
made a forced landing here, was iced up.
At here, Boston.
Yeah.
Oh. Yeah. That's what I didn't see.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, there's a lot of little flights on these things we used to make.
Yeah.
You remember the B-26?
Yes. The one that crashed off the end there?
Yeah, what? No, I mean all B-26.
Yes. Yeah. The 62nd had a 26, but didn't it go eventually?
Oh, I don't know. I don't know if it did. No, I don't remember that. But I remember going to Paris and getting some stuff.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I remember the 26.
Oh, yeah.
I thought it crashed just off the end of the runway.
I don't remember that. I don't know.
Do you remember a P-51 crashing in the 62nd site up here?
Mm-hmm. Roger, I seen that.
Do you?
Yeah, I do. I seen it, personally seen it. He come in and missed approach. He pulled up and then just when he went like that, the whole engine went right straight in.
Those propellers went all the way to the heart.
What happened?
Well, he was running very, very rough. It was really out of sync. And he must have landed long, and the tower told him he better pull up and go around. So he did. And as he was coming back over past the 61st and came around by the 62nd hangars, it just stopped and he went boom. So we were standing out in front of the 62nd, 63rd, because we had the same ready rooms. We made a dash right toward the briefing hut. We got to the plane, there's no pilot in it. What the hell happened here? What happened, the seat all came out. Then we started looking in the tall grass. The grass was about that tall. Your father forgot to cut it.
Yeah.
Then we found the body laying here in that tall grass. It just kept part of the ripped seat. The whole kit and caboodle.
Mm-hmm.
So then the MPs come fast and they just
get out and go away and go back to the regulars.
Well, in the afternoon, it was not too bad, you know, like 2-3 o'clock in the afternoon.
Yeah, someone
clear, visibility is great, just that was running terrible.
There was something definitely wrong with the engine, because she...
It's too bad he didn't get down the first time, it'd be a lot of pain. But I don't know whether he decided to go, or the tower told him to pull up and go around, or what, I have no idea, never got around all the way.
Well, interestingly, I wasn't aware of that crash, but the particular field, when we took that over, we didn't take that over, that field, until after the end of that year. When we plowed it for several years, there was one spot where the ground was purple, the soil was purple, and nothing would grow, and couldn't understand it. And then one day, I had a bunch of 56 pictures, and there was a picture of a P-51 burning on that spot. So that was the answer to that.
Purple was probably hydraulic fluid.
Yeah, the soil was actually purple. I asked Robin here whether it still was, but he says no. Nothing would ever grow there. Any more stories from your wicked past here, or any comments on any...
She wanted to dance. I wanted to drink, and Colonel Schilling said, you're going to attend bar. So with that, the air raid came. I said, come on, Sib, I'll take you home in that truck. And she said, you're not getting me in that damn lorry. And the blackout, she took two steps back, and you couldn't see her. So that was the end of that romance.
You met an American, and you didn't care for him. You just had to get outside and step back, and they couldn't find you.
They'd always stop 2 or 3 blocks from home. And they'd walk.
That's all the way you live.
They'd walk up to some house, you know, and then in the blackout you'd lose them. So the next day you go back and you bang on the door, and some old Englishman comes.
Oh, yeah.
Do you remember that?
No, he's never told me that story.
Oh, I'm sure he wasn't involved, because I think the guy was killed.
He
went at the, what we call a roundabout up here, where the railway is close by. This guy went down there with a 6x6 truck with all the station laundry.
Yeah, I remember.
Only reason I know is because I remember the hole in the fence. And
I remember just before when we were going to send the men home, I had a detail of new men from the States. And mm-hmm. we had these new trucks with the canvas tops.
Mm-hmm.
And going to one of the bases where we were collecting the guys going home,
mm-hmm.
that this truck was going down and it was dark. And some English crane had the boom lowered, and it didn't clear. The truck didn't clear it, and killed 3 men on the back of it. And we had a hell of an accident with that. I still have pictures home of that.
Where'd that happen?
Somewhere between here and one of the others, Swaffham Morley or something.
That's right, Steeple Morden.
Steeple Morden is where we were taking the men back to.
That's right.
And on the way to there, they had this accident.
Now
I got the pictures of that home and. We had an awful lot of inquiries in it, you know.
I've asked you about the FW-190 that was supposedly cut up and buried, haven't
I? It was cut up and buried. Yeah. Old Master Sergeant Hubler has got parts of it.
Dave?
Dave, yeah, he's got the peak top tube and something out of the cockpit. Well,
I'm fairly certain I know where, if anywhere, it was buried. It's somewhere near the butts. There was a damn great hole there. It was the obvious place. They put everything else in it.
Well, we had this little bulldozer with the engineers. Now, at different sites, you know, the living sites,
mm-hmm.
we would take the bulldozer, that little trail, you know, and we'd dig a hole there and take all the garbage out of there. Well, I didn't. They had details in there. And they buried it, you know.
But to bury an aircraft, particularly as it was against the 60-second hangar, because that was painted up in 60-second markings at that 190.
Yeah.
I didn't know. This is what I want. Go on.
All right.
Still build buildings.
Well, anyway,
still build buildings.
The 60-second logo was a Colonel Schilling's dog,
was a
Buster. Buster was the dog's name. And Walt Disney artists took a photograph of that, and they drew up this logo for us. And I have the original photograph sent. Now, they started it at, this dog was up at Windsor Locks, Connecticut. And old Red and I had to take him home nights and stuff like that. But this, they started making that logo while we were at Windsor Locks, but it didn't catch up with us until we were Halesworth. Mm-hmm. And what they did, instead of sending the regular drawing that they make, they took a photograph of this drawing and they sent it. But they made sure it was copyrighted.
That's typical of Walt Disney.
Yeah.
Mm. Well, my name is Dick Walbois, and I flew with the 63rd Squadron of the 56th Fighter Group. And D-Day, which become very important, it all started real, actually the day before, because the three of us were on the elite, I don't know what they call us, guys that sit by the tower with warm engines, I don't know what they call them, but late alert, I guess they call them. So we got out of the airplanes about 10:30 that night, went up the mess hall, got a cup of coffee, walked across that creek, which I'm sure we did to the BOQ, which had been about midnight. And then we had a rude awakening at 1:30 in the morning, and we found out later that it wasn't the invasion, it was a Bren gun carrier that blew up. And so we turned to put our head back down again. In 45 minutes, the IO officer came in and said, "Briefing in 45 minutes, gentlemen." So we grabbed another cup of coffee, went down to the ready room, over the briefing room. We took off at 3:32, I think, that morning, and we was Gus Gabby was leading that show. The show, I forgot who was leading it. Was it Gabby leading that particular one?
Yeah.
So we got back at 8:30 that morning, and we had a cup of coffee or etc. And then they split up by squadrons, going out and dive bombing bridges, strafing troops, whatever. So we took off like about 10 o'clock and flew about 2 hours, went back up around 2, flew a couple more hours, went back at 4. And then Don Goodflesh says, "Lieutenant, I got a good job for you." I said, "What might that be?" I think he was still a captain at that time. He hadn't got his majority because everybody was, I don't know whose idea it was. Nobody got very many promotions in the 56th, leastwise when I was there. So he says, "Well, the commanders on Normandy are having a little problem here in London. So we need somebody to go up and down the channel by the French coast. And if any messages come through that need be relaying, you do it." So I said, "Well, how long I got to stay up there?" He said, "Well, you got to stay up there 3.5-4 hours anyway." I said, "Oh, boy." Which meant now you're talking about 7:30 before I get down out of there. So I went up, but I didn't really get any messages. But what a view, because I'm directly over the smoke screen. So I'm seeing the boats coming in, the Navy with their salvo, then the other side, and here you see all the boats piling up on the beach, and the Germans shooting back at them. And so that was a bird's eye view of the Normandy landing. I think I had the best seat of anybody in the whole world up there at 32,000 feet that afternoon. Black button.
You know, what sort of guys were these?
Dealing with my squadron COs, in the short time I was there, but you can figure it out from April to September, was not very long. But I did get in 78 missions and just under 300 hours because we were flying quite a bit. D-Day alone was 13 hours, so you don't have to do too many days like that and you got your time in. But the first one I had was Bob Lamb, and he was a very flamboyant person, as I understand it. He was a vocalist with some big orchestra in the States before he became in the 56th Fighter Group. My second one was Don Goodflesh, and he was getting fairly close to being ready to go back to the States for R&R. And he was a little more on the military side, which a couple of times he did chastise me for falling off the colonel's wing one day in a solid bank, an inverted spin. I got the thing out, landed at an English air base. After dropping the bombs, the tank wouldn't fall off because the sway bars were all goofed up. I got back to the field later, and he sent me on another mission immediately. When I come back down from there, he says, you know what you got now? And I said, no. He says, 5 hours of link training. I said, 5 hours of link training for what? You should have bailed out. I said, I didn't even know where I was. And there's clouds, the fog. What am I going to bail out? I know upside down and right side in. But he still gave me 5 hours of link trainer, which I never did because I gave the corporal a nice, great big bottle of scotch. And I just signed the log for the 5 hours for the 7 days I took it. And he flew me all over according to the link trainer, but I never got upset with the link trainer, all that. The next one was Joe Egan's, and he came over, and he was not used to ground strafing. He was used to being up there at 30, 32,000. So he decided this one day we'd do a little ground strafing. And I, unfortunately, am the guy that called in the train. And it sat there very pretty, smoke coming out of the stack, a high wire where you had to come in high to get down. You had to go up over it to come down at it. So he said, well, don't any of you guys follow me. I'll go in on this alone. And he had a brand new D-25 bubble job, pretty. We're all flying little D-15s and et cetera. Man, when he stood barreling down on that train, those boxcars just opened wide. And those old 88 started pumping at him. And he just went right in. So I quick made a fast pass to see if the canopy was going to open and see whatever happened, but the canopy never did open. So that was the end of Joe Egan's.
Did he go straight in?
No, glided in. He went, he did almost a complete roll because he was barreling so fast and he had the rudder in, contact, you know, take care of the torque. Then when he got hit, he must have released his stuff and it just did a nice roll, but hit the ground straight and just went through the woods and the wings just peeled off it. But the canopy never opened.
It didn't fire?
No, never caught on fire. No, no. But the troops were right there because as I pulled up, I saw a barracks. I don't even know where we were. But all these guys ran out of the barracks and started shooting at us with rifles. So it had to be an installation of some German troops. I don't even know where it was right now.
When you say it went over the wire, what, was this sort of electric wires?
Yeah, uh-huh. I figured they're high-tension wires. But they were right near the railroad, which a lot of times they ran at a great level. But they were high enough that you couldn't come down straight at it or go under them. You'd be too low. So you had to come up and kind of pop a stick and go down that way.
Was this in Germany or in France?
In Germany. Well, now I won't even say that. Too bad I don't know where we were. You'd have to look up where Joe Egan's went down. That's where we were. I don't really know. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Then came Buddy Comstock, and there's only one Buddy Comstock, as everybody knows, because he, as it turned out, Eugene Timoney, someone who just died a short time ago, he and I became, as it turned out, Walt Flagg, who lived with us, Eugene Timoney and myself, we lived together. We all got appointed flight leaders at the same time, and he just kind of took a liking to us three guys. I don't know why. Maybe we drank the same kind of coffee or drank the same kind of beer, but he was a real gentleman, but he was a fighter, and he went looking for airplanes, and we were out there. He wasn't there just to fool around or spend some time up in the air. He wanted to find something to shoot and do it.
What about old Hart? Some people liked him, some people disliked him. Did you have anything to do with him?
Colonel Zemke? Mm-hmm. Well, as I say, I flew his wing that one day, and we started off, and I don't think the ceiling was over 600 feet. We had on two 250s and a 165-gallon belly tank. Mm-hmm. We started climbing up through that thing, and if anybody who ever flew with Hub knows he was a great guy to ride top rudder and let that right wing go down. And all of a sudden he decided he wanted to use the pilot relief tube, and that made it even worse. And I was watching him, and all of a sudden that right wing went down, and I said, roll back, and I went like that, and that's why I went inverted. So it knocked my radio out. I could hear these guys later on. Well, I got it out of that thing because I had the thing happen to P-40 back in the States one time. The manual says don't chop throttle, but I found a P-40, you chop throttle and get some that nose down, not holding it up. So I come across the got down to the water. I knew I was straight because all the instruments tumbled. So I thought, well, you know, I was doing about 550, 600 miles an hour at that point in time. I said, well, I'll just let it coast because the pops just windmilling out there. And I went for a little while, and I said, well, better give it a little throttle. Man, all the way to the stop, and nothing. Oh, boy. Then I looked at the fuel pressure, and it was zero. Oh, wait, I've been climbing on outboard. I better reach down and get an inboard. So I switched the inboard, and they go, oh, boy, now I got some engine. So I went up a little right to the bottom of the overcast, which might have been 500 miles, 500 feet, rather, and dropped the bombs, got rid of those. Now I try to get rid of the belly tank. Nothing. So I said, well, I better get back to land, and I'm hearing these guys on the RT popping out at 19,000. I'm screaming, I'm down here, you know. Nothing. Nobody acknowledged, so evidently I was not transmitting to anybody, but I could receive. So I took the reciprocal heading, I wound up at a Sterling base, and the guy, I sort of buzzed the tower, and he says, is that P-47 want landing instructions? So I give him a little wagon. He says, okay, he told me the thing. So I come down, and he says, you got a bomb or something on? And so I didn't answer him. He says, is that a tank? So I wagged the tank. He says, you better go over the tower and let us take a peek at that thing. So I went over the tower real slow, 150 miles an hour or so, 160 maybe. He says, that looks clear. You can land. So I came around like that, and I threw the handle down there. Like a roll back. What's that? You know. But the sway bars is in that inverted spin and turn like that, and I couldn't raise it to drop it, because you have to pull those things up. Our bombs are raised with the thing, you know, to pull the pin out to release it. And then when they got it in the shop, they just took the tank off. That's when I got back and good flesh came in.
The tank was dragging on the runway.
No. We're just cockeyed on the fuselage. Just cockeyed on the fuselage. No, it wasn't dragging. Just cockeyed on the fuselage. And when those wheels went down, we're just rubbing on the one side. That was just reeking. But that hydraulic was good enough. It just moved that tank right out of the way and come down anyway. So that was a blessing like that. That's enough about me.
And which pub is this?
All right, now, you know when you come from the railroad station?
Yes.
And you're going to come up Mile End Road?
Yes.
Now, not go up around the other road, but the one that come in close. Yes. Right there, there was a pub there on the corner. Yes. It's gone now.
Yes.
Well, somebody in that building had a taxi.
Mm-hmm.
So what we used to do, just up from the pub, maybe 50 feet, there was a big hedge.
Mm-hmm.
So when we'd get by with a truck, right, like 2, 3 o'clock in the morning, we'd run 5 gallons of petrol in, gasoline. But any time we needed a taxi, he was always ready for it. So like maybe once or twice a month, we'd drop him 5 gallons of petrol.
And so, while we could hear him screaming at the other Chinaman, and then the interpreter would come back to us, a lot of the radio out in Holyoke. And so Hubbard gives instructions back to the interpreter, and he'd tell the Chinese about it. And all of a sudden, Hubbard calls the Chinaman and says, for Christ's sake, all you got to do is put the gear down. That was the Chinese problem. One guy was coming in and landing with the gear up, and the other one was trying to come up with the gear down.
I was on an airport guard hangar duty at Bradley Field in 1941, when all these Chinese were flying P-40s. It was a Sunday, and the engineering officer was going back to Windsor Box, where he lived. He says, if anything happens, let me know. Call me. Within 20 minutes, when the Chinese came in, hit the ground,